I don't know if it's ever happened before where the same text was being used Sunday morning and Sunday night. It just happened that way. The same passage this morning was used to highlight the love of Christ for His church, which is a sub-theme of the passage, but the major theme is husbands' love for their wives and wives' submission to their husbands, and then but the love of Christ for His church and the church's submission to Christ, her Lord, is the pattern, provides the pattern that we're to follow. As is the case in so much in life, Jesus is the pattern. We walk in His steps. We follow in His path. We are His disciples. We take up our cross and we follow Him. And so it's not surprising that when it comes to the family codes that we find in the New Testament that we find the pattern for family life is to be found in our heavenly family. Our Father who is in heaven, His beloved Son, His love for His bride, the church, and so forth. And this is part of a larger series on wisdom, and that's going to be the emphasis. Here, as in everything, there are no exhaustive patterns that we can point to. There's no formula that we can invoke and apply that's going to answer all the questions that we have about family life. There's no easy 1, 2, 3 steps that are going to solve the problems that we have of husbands or wives or as children or as parents or in all of the complexity of family life. Behind that complexity is the complexity of human beings. No two of whom are alike, and for every which of one, there are nuances of response and need to which a wise person is going to be very sensitive. Every one of us has different requirements of love and of a sense of fairness and needs. And so we're going to need to pay close attention to the variables and seek wisdom as we look at husbands this week, and hopefully we'll progress enough through that we'll be looking at wives next week. But if not, then we'll spend a couple of weeks on husbands, and we could use that. I don't think we could spend too much time on the duties of husbands or the duties of wives. I guess eventually we would tire of it, but there's so much to say, so much to consider, that let's go ahead and get started, and let's see how far that we get. So there are two commands that we have here, essentially, from the Apostle Paul with respect to husbands. He wants us, husbands, to love their wives and to lead their wives. So let's look first at love your wives. Look at verse 25. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself up for her. How are husbands to love their wives? The pattern is in the death of Christ, the way that Christ loved His church. How did He love His church? He gave Himself up for His church. He laid down His life for His church. So that the love of a husband follows the pattern of the atonement. It is a love that encompasses absolute and total sacrifice of the husband on behalf of the welfare of his wife. His outlook is to be that all that he does is to protect and to provide for his wife, even if it means his own death. And so everything that he does then, arguing from the greater to the lesser, if he is to sacrifice even his life for the welfare of his wife, then it means that all lesser considerations also are to be worked through that grid. If I'm going to spend the day playing golf, I don't just do that unilaterally. I do that in light of the requirement here that I love my wife the way that Christ loves the church. There are days when I'm sure that's a fine thing to do, when that's a perfectly fitting thing to do. But I don't just do that because it's owed to me or because somehow in the cosmic balance of justice that I have it coming. I do that in light of all considerations up there at the top of which is this requirement that I lay down my life for my wife. And that means I can lay down my golf clubs too for my wife, right? Isn't that the argument from the greater to the lesser? If that much is required, if I'm required to lay down my life, well then I can lay down my golf clubs or my hunting rifle, or I can turn off the television, or I can miss a game. That's the argument here. Jesus takes us all the way to the extreme. Here's the way that you're to love your wife. Here's the way love your wife, the way that Christ loves his church. He laid down his life. He sacrificed life itself for the benefit of his church. How then are husbands to love their wives? They're to lay down their rods and reels if they have to in order to love their wives. So it's the total sacrifice of oneself for the sake of one's wife. I have to work my the promotion that's being offered through that grid. I can't just accept unilaterally the promotion. It might be the right thing to do, but I accept it in light of this requirement that I love my wife as Christ loves the church. I can't work 12 or 16 hours a day unilaterally, just deciding to do that because I want to be advanced in my profession. I want to be recognized in my profession. I want a reputation. I want to grow. I can't just do that without consideration of the impact that that has upon my wife, for whom I am called to exercise a love that is utterly self-sacrificial and self-effacing. I have to work all that through the lens of this passage and this requirement of the apostle that I lay down my life for my wife. So I need to be asking myself constantly as a married man, what do I need to give on behalf of my wife? What do I need to give up on behalf of my wife to ensure her well-being? He goes on, look at verses 28 and through 30. He says, so husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. You know, we take pretty good care of our own bodies, some more so than others, to be sure, and we differ in the ways that we take care of our own bodies. Some of us take care of our own bodies by exercising them and ensuring that they are in top condition. Others of us take care of our bodies by ensuring that they are well fed. You know, there might be a time when there's no longer any food on the grocery shelves, the shelves of the grocery store. So, you know, in case of famine, we're storing up. But we are taking care of our bodily appetites, our bodily needs, are we not? I'm just being slightly facetious here. But we're taking care of our bodily requirements as we perceive them to be. So that's the parallel. He's not saying necessarily that you're being wise about the way that you're taking care of your body. The fact of the matter is we take care of our bodies. We take care of ourselves. We ensure that we are bathed and groomed and fed and comfortable and entertained. And the list goes on. We spend tremendous energy and resources ensuring the well-being of ourselves, or the well-being of our bodies. Well, that's the way that we're to see our wives, as an extension of ourselves, getting that kind of devoted attention. This was the big fallacy when the psychological gurus about 20 years ago were saying that when Jesus said you need to love your neighbor as yourself, he was teaching us to love ourselves. It was just totally a misconstruing of the passage. Jesus assumes we love ourselves. Not that we need to be encouraged to love ourselves. The problem is that we love ourselves to the exclusion of everyone else. We are so utterly devoted to our own interests, needs, desires, passions, appetites, that we never quite ever get around to loving our neighbors. And so he is saying, lavish upon others the same kind of devoted attention that you lavish upon yourself. Here, he's calling for that in particular and in a focused way and in an extended way for a husband to love his wife as Christ loves the church. And for further illustration, he uses the metaphor of our own bodies, as you love your own body. She's to get that kind of devoted attention. Now, I had a little itch right here on my head, and I just scratched it. I met the need of my body. So I would say, if your wife has an itch, you scratch it. She has a need. You said about the intention to fulfill it, all in wisdom, of course. But this is what we do for ourselves. Consequently, this is what we do for our wives. If there is a hurt, we seek to heal it. If there's a hunger pang, we seek to satisfy that. If there is an ache, we seek to soothe it. If there's an itch, we seek to scratch it. 31. For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. He's quoting from Genesis chapter 2. This is the theology behind the love of a husband for his wife. Verse 32, this mystery is great, but I am speaking with reference to Christ and the church. There's a unity between the man and the woman. The two become one flesh. They become one person. And the man is that head of that new person. And so he's not only to love, but he's the lead. So we're going to see that in a minute here. But there is this unity, this mystery. He calls it a mystery in verse 32. This mystery is great. This mystical union between Christ and his church is paralleled in the mystical union between a man and his wife as the two become one. One new person, one new purpose together. No longer two, but one. No longer seeking one's own agenda and one's own goals and one's own ambitions, but always working that through in terms of the purpose of the two together. Not lording it over, but loving and therefore sacrificing and sacrificing by embracing one's wife in all of one's considerations, all of one's ambitions, all of one's purposes in life. Why? Because you're one person. You're no longer two. You can't think as an autonomous individual, as one isolated and apart from this person that you have married. You have been bound together now. You are one person. And so you can't think in terms of my things and her things and my bank account and her bank account and my career and her career. That first personal pronoun ought to be banished from marriage. It doesn't fit anymore. They're our purposes, our things. We work in harmony. We work in unity. So husbands are to love their wives. Verse 33, let each individual among you love his own wife even as himself. Even as himself. Underscoring that same purpose. Now, when we turn to 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, we saw this a year or 2 years ago as we were working our way through 1 Peter. But Peter there illustrates, I think, in a very helpful way, verse 7 of chapter 3, 1 Peter. He says, husbands, likewise, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman, and grant her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. Live with your wife in an understanding way. Be a student of your wife. Know your wife up and down, inward and out. Understand, in Peter's terms, understand that she's the weaker vessel. She's different. She is not as you are. There is physical weakness compared to you as the husband. There isn't the brute physical strength that a man has. You need to understand that and be sensitive to that, and yet also be sensitive that she is a fellow heir of the grace of life. And so she is an equal. She is an equal. Love your wives. But he also says that we are to lead our wives. Verse 23, the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church. He himself being the Savior of the body. Which between the two is the greater need to love or to lead? I don't know. I think that they are both crucial and necessary and neglected, really, just neglected. I think that we fail to love our wives as husbands, and I think we also fail to lead our wives. And both of those are very significant problems. So when we say that there's to be this total sacrifice. This total sacrifice is not total surrender. All right, you're to lay down your life for me now, and here's what I want, and so you better do, or you're not going to be obedient to what the Bible says. That's total surrender. That's not total sacrifice. There are times when a husband will lead in a way that defies the wishes and the perceived needs of his wife. That's what it means to lead. That's what it means to lead in the political realm, right? There are times when you have to defy the electorate. If you're a good leader, you are going to say no to the people at times. You're going to say no to other leadership. You're going to have to stand firm, even though all of the loud voices of our society are saying something else. And so it is in the home. There's going to be times when a husband is required to say no, where he's going to be required to stand firm. He's going to be required to exercise leadership for the family. Total sacrifice is not total surrender. He is called to be the head of the wife. She, in turn, is called, in verse 22, to be subject to her own husband. And in verse 24, as the church is subject to Christ, so also wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. So let's just digress again to talk about what Christian leadership is. I think we go over this a couple of times every year, so let me just briefly touch it. Christian leadership is initiative, not orders. It is servant leadership. We don't lead like Gentiles do. Jesus says in Matthew 20, verses 20 through 28, we don't lead like pagans do. They lord it over. They give commands. They're issuing orders. That's not the way Christians lead, not anywhere, but particularly not in the family. To be a good leader means you're taking the initiative. Take Steve Jobs, the CEO of Apple Computers. Now, his leadership, I don't know if he barks commands, but that's not what makes him an effective leader. What makes him an effective leader is the ability to initiate, to perceive where the market might go, needs of the market, requirements of the market, and design products for it, like the iPod. I mean, it was a stroke of genius. All of a sudden, everybody in America was buying an iPod. That's leadership. Was he barking orders at everybody and telling everyone what to do and screaming and shouting and carrying on? No. He was perceiving where the market was moving and how his company could meet the demands of the market with a product that people would want to buy. That's initiative. That's taking the pulse of the country. That's being aware of where people are and what kind of conveniences they'd like to have and coming up with the right product. That's what leadership is. That's what leadership is in the political realm as well. That's what leadership is in the church as well. It is perceiving the needs of the congregation in light of the requirements of God and tweaking the program of the church to meet the needs. You know, looking at where we are deficient, looking at where we are strong, looking at where we can do better, looking at where we can improve, and rallying the troops in such a way that the church gets behind that, initiating action by the church in order to improve and grow its ministry. Well, that's what a husband does, a proper husband. He's not barking orders at everyone. He's not ordering his wife around. He's not ordering his children around. He's initiating in areas of improvement and growth that are necessary for the well-being of his wife and of his family. The word to be subject to, as well as to be the head of, the meaning of those words change depending on the object of the orders or the object of the leadership, the ones being led, right? You say, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. My dog is subject to me. My dogs, lest I forget Scout. We have two dogs. Those dogs are subject to me, and I give commands and orders to them. But our concept of commands and orders, when it applies to dogs, is a little bit different than when it applies to adult human beings, right? It has a different nuance. It has a different meaning. We all understand that. You order your dogs around in a way that you don't order your children around, and in different ways than you order your workers down at the plant about, or that you would give direction to your spouse. Those words alter, they alter in their meaning. There are nuances to those words. We tweak the meaning of those words. The subject may remain the same. It may be me in relation to my children or in relation to my animals or in relation to my wife. The subject may be the same, but the object changes the meaning of the verbs. So I don't give orders. I don't give commands. I don't provide leadership for my children in the same way that I do for my dogs. And I don't provide leadership for my wife in the same way that I do for my children. Right? We lead image bearers in ways that are different than we lead non-image bearers. And we lead adult image bearers differently than we do children who are image bearers. That's the kind of thing that needs to be kept in mind. But it seems to escape. This fundamental piece of common sense seems to escape some people. I've mentioned previous times, you know, the, my dear friend in elementary school and middle school, Bobby Knaus. I'll never forget his father shouting, you know, at the top of his voice, where I'm out in the backyard, we're playing, you know, tackle football out in the backyard, and I can hear him shouting at the top of his voice, "I'm the head of this house." We're all out in the yard. There's only one person he's yelling that to. I don't know if it was to convince himself or what, but he would thunder that at the top of his voice, "I'm the head of this house." Well, I don't think he was any more successful at establishing that by that means than anyone ever has been. But that's not the way that we exercise leadership in the Christian community, in the Christian family, in a Christian endeavor of any sort. It's by taking initiative, which means that we are perceiving and listening to and studying and then acting upon the emotional and spiritual and material needs of our families, our wives and our children, as we come to understand them. That's what a wise husband is doing. He is listening, studying, perceiving, and then initiating, acting upon his understanding of what those emotional, spiritual, and material needs are within the family. Not emotional to the exclusion of spiritual, not spiritual to the exclusion of material, not material to the exclusion of emotional and spiritual. That's been a problem too, right? Husbands who have been great material providers, they really brought home the bacon. I mean, the family was well taken care of materially, but emotionally, absentee. Spiritually, out to lunch, making no contribution at all. No, the whole realm, emotional, spiritual, material. Often these outstanding material providers have been virtual slugs when it comes to the life of the family. Right? Work hard all day long and commend them for that. Great hard workers, providers, 1950s dads. And right up to the present day, out there in the labor force, dealing with bosses and employees all day long, coming home exhausted, collapsing into the easy chair, and then basically slugs for the rest of the evening. And disconnected from the emotional life of the family, disconnected from the conduct of the children, disconnected from the emotional needs of his wife, disconnected from the spiritual condition of the family, but materially providing. That was the great burden of the 50s dads. You could argue that that's one of the reasons why the 1950s produced the 1960s. Great material provision, but negligence in the emotional and spiritual realm. So, husbands, if we can expand the category here a little bit, they're also then to lead their children. Husbands are to love their wives, lead their wives, and lead, and we could say as well, love their children. Chapter 6, verse 4, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up." Fathers, you are responsible to bring them up. It doesn't say wives bring them up. And certainly a lot of that bringing up is delegated to wives who have more immediate contact with the children. But ultimately, the responsibility is placed upon the fathers by the apostle. Fathers, bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Not fathers see to their material provision, but fathers ensure that they are brought up in the Lord's discipline and instruction, the Lord's nurture and admonition. Those beautiful old King James words, the nurture and instruction of the Lord. So men of the church, and you know, if you are a single man or a single woman and you are not yet in the family context, I think that the value here is that this gets you thinking about what is liable to happen and what you need to be looking for. Isn't it 98% of all Americans end up getting married at some time or another in their lives? That means you either are a husband at some point or you will be husband. You will marry a husband at some point. You have fathers who have husbands. You have children who will be husbands. You have nephews who will one day be husbands, grandchildren who will one day be husbands. There's value in what we're doing here, as well as this providing something of a glimpse of the fatherhood of God as we consider ideal fatherhood as the basis upon which we say all that we are saying here this evening. But I think we all recognize, and there's no sense reviewing the litany of failure in the family today. We see the fruit of that failure around us all every day. The human wreckage is astonishing. And I would say one positive thing to say about last Tuesday's election is that the president-elect would appear to me to be a very strong family man, devoted to his wife and devoted to his children. That can't but be a good thing. Given the pathologies in the inner cities today, that cannot but be a good figure. This is a role model whose time has come. So we'll be praying for the president-elect and praying that that will be part of the benefit that comes from his administration. We have elected a minority man who is a strong man of the family and a devoted husband. That's a good thing, because we are desperate for that. The illegitimacy rate amongst white Americans is 30%. Amongst black Americans, it's astonishingly high. There's a breakdown of the family, and at the heart of the breakdown of the family is the abandonment of responsibility by men. That, it really is the cause, and it really is the cure. Is that if men will do what they're called to do and understand what they're called to do, to be more than just material provision. I mean, there are some sectors where that needs to be established. You are responsible for the material well-being of your family. But it, of course, it goes vastly beyond that. You're responsible that your children be brought up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. You're responsible to love your wives as Christ loves the church. And there's really no excuses. You can't say, well, you don't know what she's like. I just think that's a cop-out. I was going to say something funny, but it's really not all that funny. It's just a cop-out. I don't believe that all the problems in the family are the fault of men. I do believe that the solution lies, by and large, with men. Determining to love their wives, determining not to abandon leadership in the home, either because of their own responsibility or fear of female hysteria, but who will lead their families, exercising tough love and rearing their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. If that happens in the families of the church throughout all of Christendom, we'll see a revival like we've never seen before. And many of society's sicknesses will begin to be healed. But more importantly, we as a congregation, and those of you who are husbands, need to recommit, redevote yourselves to loving your wives as Christ loves the church. And on this note, not the least of which so that the world will see in the love of the husbands of this church for their wives, the love of Christ for his church. And Jesus had a very imperfect bride, and he still does, but he loves his bride. He loves his church. And our love for our wives is to be a reflection of that love so that the world is able to see the love of Christ for sinners. They're to see a picture of the gospel. Marriage is not a sacrament, but it almost is. It's an external, visual picture of internal spiritual realities. May we love in that fashion as we pray together.